40 years ago, right now, right about now, was the first graduating class at Maharshi International University. And when we think about change makers, we have to go back to the founder of this university. And it's not just disruption. The term they use is disruptive innovation. So anybody can disrupt. You can have a five-year-old kid who disrupts nonstop. That's not what we want. What we want is disruptive innovation, to start from basically nothing and create, against all odds, something transformative. And that is the definition of Maharshi Mahesh Yogi's life. And it's also the definition, to a lesser extent, but still very profound and powerful, for the people who have been in this community since the beginning, and all of you who have come and joined as students, as faculty, as staff, as members of families. You're real disruptive innovators. And that's conviction and persistence. So we honor you for that. And we're going to go right into, oh, one other thing I want to say. There's going to be a group meditation when we're done. And Virginia, where's Virginia? Raise your hand. Oh, over there, is going to come down and have everyone start. So we're going to, in all the different rooms, we're going to do a little 10-minute meditation. Okay, that'll be a great way to end the whole thing. When I think of our first two speakers, I think of a beautiful quote from the Bhagavad Gita, which is an exemplary of this term of conviction and persistence. And that quote is, "We have control over action alone, never over the fruits. We just do the best we can over and over and over, but we do it intelligently. We don't keep knocking on a brick wall when the door is 5 feet over here. We look, we're able to pivot and be nimble and try new approaches. But we have control over action alone, never over its fruits. We don't do things for its fruits. We do things for the purity and genuineness and authenticity and creativity and intelligence of the action." And these two people, and I'm going to read their bios, and if their four-year-old daughter, Mona, is going to run the world, their four-year-old daughter, she is scary powerful in a beautiful way. Laura Dawn was one of the founding members in creative and culture, and is the creative and cultural director, was the creative and cultural director of the political action group MoveOn.org. Laura spent the last decade leading groundbreaking cultural campaigns which have achieved over 500 million online views. Where's Ron Barnett? Her forte is viral content creation and high-level collaborations between renowned artists and grassroots activists to spur action for social change. She is joined by her partner and co-creator, Darren Murphy, on their latest initiative, the cultural strategy firm Art Not War. And she was also the lead singer for Moby, and you heard her last night. Her husband, Darren Murphy, is the co-founder with Laura Dawn, Art Not War. He worked for 2 years as the principal of creative and production team responsible for all television, radio, and online video content for MoveOn.org. He has also had a career as a musician and a journalist, writing for publications such as the Wall Street Journal and Bloomberg Businessweek. Thank you very much for coming to Iowa, to our home. Please welcome Laura Dawn and Darren. Are you mic'd? We need mics. So what we're going to do is I'm going to ask them about just a few questions, and then they're going to make about a 15-minute presentation, the two of them, and then after that, take questions from you for about 10 minutes. So that's the format. And As we said last night, this isn't so much about, oh, I've done these things. It's more, who are you and what experiences did you have as a child or in your life that gave you the passion, the conviction, the motivation, the resilience to rise above and achieve something great? And all of our panelists have done that. And so my first question for both of you is, was there a moment in your childhood where you knew you wanted to become an artist?
Yes.
That's good.
Probably several, but one that really sticks out is when I was about 7 or 8, they showed the movie Gandhi on TV. And I watched the entire thing, and I was riveted. And I'm very sure I didn't know that India even existed. I certainly had not known that Gandhi existed. And I was so transported by this that I went to my little country school, Pleasantville Elementary, and I went to the library and I said, I need books on India, Gandhi, yoga, and the librarian was
like,
what? You
were 7 years old?
7 years old, she was like, what? I don't think we have any books on those subjects in your age range. And I pushed and pushed the librarian, whose name was Marion, the librarian. So that was her name. And I used to, this is also true, I used to ride my horse into town and park it outside the library and sit in there.
For those of you who were not here last night.
I'm from Pleasantville, Iowa.
Population?
1,000.
Yes.
Okay. And so I started reading everything she would let me. And sometimes she would actually sit with me and read things that were beyond my reading level. And then once I had heard all about his story and India and what happened there to him, I wanted to know how they made that movie. It was the first time that I think I understood someone made that. Someone told his story, and this little girl in the middle of a tiny farm in Pleasantville, Iowa, could hear that story. And I think at that point forward, I wanted to be a person that told those stories. I think that was it.
Yeah. Was there a defining moment when you became an activist?
I can answer that too. But as you can tell, you should maybe answer one.
I think that I think that there was a moment where Laura and I had moved to Los Angeles, where we live there now, but this was 15 years ago. We lived there for just about 2 years, and we moved. We were both we were professional musicians, and the Iraq War was just about to start, and we were already kind of really, really sad that George W. Bush had become the president, and we were kind of doing this music, which was very fulfilling, but it felt like there were bigger things going on in the world that we weren't able to address through the music, and I couldn't believe that they were about to invade Iraq. And I remember driving to a crappy temporary job that was helping support our professional music, and being stuck on the 10 freeway in LA, surrounded by cars, and they were talking about how the whole reason that we're invading Iraq was because of a war for oil. And I'm just sitting there stuck in the middle of the road burning oil, and I thought, you know, I can't believe this. I'm if I don't do something about this, I'm just part of the problem. And right after that, we ended up moving back to New York and getting involved with Move On and just starting our career of activism.
And I can just add to that, I knew that I knew I wanted to do something more than just be an artist. And so one of the first things that I did is I volunteered for the Howard Dean campaign. And he was coming to, I don't know if anyone remembers that Howard Dean ran for president, but he seemed very fresh and new, and he was saying things that I liked. And I thought, I'll volunteer. And I was actually really afraid to do that. I was really afraid that I didn't have anything to offer them. And I showed up at their event in New York City, and honestly, it was kind of a mess. Like, there was a press tent, and there was a volunteer. There were all these volunteers. There was nobody leading them. And I just kind of watched that go on for about 5 minutes. And finally, I'm so typey, I was like, you know what? I'm in charge. I'm going to do the press thing, this and that. And within like 20 minutes, I had the press check-in working. I had the volunteer check-in working. I had everybody organized. And an official from the campaign came. They're like, what's going on here? I was like, oh, I'm in charge. And I told him what was going on. And I ran that all day. And at the end of the day, I was like, oh, That wasn't that hard. I have something I can offer, so.
Now, I want to just pause here for a moment. The political views that are expressed on this stage do not necessarily represent.
I actually really like George W. Bush's paintings. Yeah. I wish I could have one of those.
He has a great career as an outside artist. I think he should just paint.
All right, one last question. And if you think Laura Dawn is an organizer, Mona, I'm telling you. Anyway, one last question before you make your presentation. Why do you, just in a word, few words, both of you, why do you believe art can influence the powerful levers of the world?
Well, it always has.
These are not my questions. These are actually Laura Dawn's questions.
Well, I believe that art can influences everything that we do in sometimes ways that we don't think of. I like to ask this question a lot, and probably it'll be a different answer in this room, but how many of you have actually participated in a war? Few. How many of you, if you close your eyes right now, can picture a scene from a war movie that you've seen? Right? So a lot of our experience of the world, and sometimes the hardest things in the world that we really need to change, come because someone has created art to share them with us. So for that reason alone, I think it's one of the most powerful levers of the world. And I also think it's always been a part of every artist, if you really take a look at it, have been at the tip of the spear of every social justice movement, pretty much as far as, certainly in this country, but I think worldwide. And so I believe strongly that art can still be the tip of that spear, and has to be. You have to change how people feel, you have to change their hearts before you can change their minds, I think. Mm-hmm.
I think you just said everything I was going to say.
thank you. Now we'll go over to our.
Hi. I'm again.
This is Laura Dawn.
I'm pretty good at standing up and singing in front of people. I have not done a lot of public speaking, so I have very type A notes here. You heard about MoveOn.org, a little bit more about them. I was the seventh person hired at MoveOn for an eventual nine-person staff. And that strange little staff, not to be too braggadocious about it, but kind of changed the face of internet activism forever. And when I started, I think there were about 250,000 members at MoveOn, and when I left, there were 8 million. And then in 2012, I started a new creative agency and production group called Art Not War. Yes, I stole that from the Shepard Fairey poster. If you Google his poster, it's really cool. Yes, he gave me his permission to do that, and now he meditates.
Yes.
And Art Not War was formed because I wanted to work on a bigger branch of issues. I wanted to work on mass incarceration. I wanted to work on gender inequality. I wanted to work on peace building and women's issues. And Art Not War was really, and MoveOn was really focused on electing, you know, progressives to office, which I still think is a worthy thing to do. So I don't want to, he kind of already gave my bio. I'm going to skip this part where I talk about myself. And just talk about how I got here, which I feel like, by all rights, I definitely should not be here. You know, the not-for-profit world, honestly, is very populated with a lot of amazing Ivy League folks, wealthy donors, you know, billionaires, a lot of folks that we might think of as 1% elites. And I was born, as we mentioned, in Pleasantville, Iowa. I was brought up in a farmhouse that had dirt floors, no running water, and an outhouse until I was 3. My dad is a welder and a butcher and a builder by trade, and he was pulled out of school in the 9th grade to work his father's farm, and he built that house with his own 2 hands, and he still lives there to this day. Both of my parents were extremely hardworking people who both grew up in abusive homes and tried their best to do a little better by their kids with varying degrees of success. When you grow up poor and in a stressful environment with alcoholism and neglect, some abuse, family members in prison, it's very easy to succumb to negativity. You know, oh, you can't go to college. That's not for people like us. You know, we don't have the money for that. We don't do those things. Only wealthy people get to do those things. And I don't know where I got this attitude from. Maybe it's the hillbilly spirit of my ancestors. But back then, I was like, don't tell me what I can't do. And I can't go to college? Fuck that. I was the first person in my family to go to college. We don't have the money for that. I paid for every cent of my education myself by working three jobs while simultaneously getting a double major. I can't go to a place like New York City and make a living in the arts. That doesn't happen for people like us. My mother really wanted me to be a pharmacist. She said that was a solid job, and it is. But I went to New York City with $300 in my pocket, which is pretty stupid. I lived first at the YWCA and then in a fairly scary squat on the Lower East Side that had a hot plate and a tub in the middle of the room where I both bathed and also washed my dishes until I got a survival job and could save up enough to get a proper apartment. And after I had that survival job, I made a list of every single place where I thought I might network and meet people and offered myself up as an intern. I just showed up and said, I will work for free if you just let me hang out and learn. And I ended up with amazing internships at Good Machine, a hugely influential film company, Naked Angels, an equally influential theater company, and the Wooster Group, which is a performance art group that I admired, that I think was started by William Dafoe. And by working around the clock, mostly for free, and eating a whole lot of ramen noodles, I met and established circles of friends and allies in New York City in the arts and entertainment world that I still have to this day. And I knew exactly no one east of Iowa when I left, but I knew that I wanted to have a creative and meaningful life, and I wasn't going to let anything like poverty and no connections stand in my way. So my bit of advice in how to be a change maker is if you want it, go get it. Knock on every door until somebody lets you in, and then make yourself indispensable. You can do that, actually. It just requires letting go of your ego, and if they need you to go on a run to get rubber bands, which somebody sent me on a run to get, you go get rubber bands faster than anyone has ever gotten rubber bands.
It's beautiful.
And know that every single person that you meet might become part of the constellation of stars that will make up your life, and they are connected, and those connections will surprise you and lift you up in your purpose if you honor them. So be aware, work hard, be a connector, and be kind. That's pretty much the only recipe I've been able to follow. So in the movie version of my life, I would join Move On right after that, but that didn't happen. In reality, I was in New York for nearly 10 years before that happened. I was in a semi-successful all-girl punk band for most of those years. I worked in an off-Broadway theater group. I did some acting and temping and bartending and made a lot of artistic friends. I got a solo record deal. I ended up meeting Darren, marrying him, tour behind that album, began singing with Moby, then 9/11 happened. Now, I'd always been a politically minded person, but I never thought that a person like me could have a voice in the political process. It was enough for me to imagine myself being an artist. I didn't imagine that my upbringing as a card-carrying member of the working poor could lead to politics. You know, I thought there are mysterious forces at work that sometimes knock the working poor flat, and there's no way to conceivably fight back against them. And if I had known that I had a way to contribute, I believe I would have, but I believe that politics was the realm of somebody else, somebody richer, more educated, or better connected, you know, somebody better than me. But after 9/11, I again said, fuck that, and I decided to try. I knew I needed to do something more, but I just wasn't sure what. So I paid attention and I waited for an opportunity, and it came. The way things serendipitously just happened, I had my solo record deal, and a guy showed up to sublet my apartment. His name was Zach Exley, and he was the fourth person hired at MoveOn.org. He eventually became a lead organizer of the Bernie Sanders presidential campaign. But back then, he was just fate showing up at my door on Avenue C to tell me about Move On. And what they were doing blew my mind. A little bit about Move On. They were started by a Berkeley couple, Wes Boyd and Joan Blaines, who put a petition online and got 250,000 signatures. Now, that might not seem like a big deal today, but back then, the reason that that was so important is that, you know, before, if you wanted to aggregate the voices of people, you had to go door to door and get those signatures in real time. You had to stand at a supermarket and get those signatures in real time. And back then, petitions actually did move politicians. So that takes a lot of time and money for that to happen, but with Move On, you could suddenly aggregate the voice of millions within days, sometimes hours. Amazing. And even more importantly, you could aggregate their money. Move On was raising enormous amounts of money at that time. You had $250,000, and then they would make a TV ad that represented the voice of the people that we didn't want to go to war in Iraq at that time, and then they would put it on TV. And they would get tons of press because they did that. That was a brand new model. No one had done that, and I knew I wanted to be a part of it. But I didn't want to show up empty-handed, so I thought, you know, what could I offer these total strangers that would make them let me work with them? I have no background in politics. I don't have an Ivy League degree. But I had a lot of creative people in my life. I knew a lot of artists. So I came up with this idea. We'll get well-known filmmakers and actors to make meaningful political ads and then use the aggregate power of the Move On membership to fund them. We'll inject the voice of people who want justice and equity for all and peace into the marketplace, and we'll piggyback on the attention that already comes to these famous artists to get attention to those voices. And I didn't know this terminology at the time, but I basically came up with my first earned media campaign, which just means that you come up with something so tasty that the media will cover it and get you lots of free publicity for your cause. So I emailed the then executive director of Move On, Eli Pariser, which he ignored. And then I emailed him again, and again, and again, and again. And I think about the 20th email, I thought, I got to offer something else. So I said, you know, I'd really like to talk to you about my ideas. We could talk about them over lunch with me and Moby. And he answered that one. So I've never, ever been afraid to pimp out anyone I've ever known to get something done. And we'll continue to. Yeah. So at that lunch meeting, we came up with this thing that became Bush in 30 seconds. Apparently, according to advertising textbooks now, it was the first user-generated ad contest where we had people all over the country make political ads. People voted on them. We got a bunch of different artists, filmmakers, and politicos to be a judging panel. It just exploded. It got a ton of attention. Not all of it good. And they ended up hiring me full-time. So within a couple of months, I was working on the staff full-time that I wanted to work on. And we worked our asses off, round the clock. We raised $60 million in small donations that year. No one had ever done that. And we were doing, you know, offline work, online work. Suddenly, I exploited Darren for as long as I could. I had to start paying him. He started working with me. I did things like tell him, go to Ohio in the middle of nowhere and throw this event with the Goo Goo Dolls and Michael Moore. Here's $1,000. Go. And as you can remember, we lost. John Kerry lost that year. But we didn't stop. We grew to 1 million members, 2 million members, 8 million members. We raised $80 million in small donations in 2008. And that year we won. We helped make history by electing Barack Obama. So at that time, I really believed. So at the time, I really believed if we just elect better people. We live in a representational democracy. If we just elect better people to represent us, life's going to be fairer, better, safer, more equitable for all. I don't know if I believe that anymore. I think that electing great people is a part of the solution. I think it's a worthy fight. But along the way, and especially after the last presidential election, I became convinced that we need to do more. We need to look deeper and go after bigger fish than just electing better people. I believe that we need to do nothing less than change the entire power structure of this country and indeed the world. And so these days I have my sights set on that. So these days at Art Not War, we spend a lot of time pushing to work on conflict resolution, on equity, justice, and diversity issues. That sometimes means getting, you know, we're working to try to get early socio-emotive learning in preschools because we think that will play just as an important part of the solution of solving the current gun crisis as changing legislation. You know, we need to do both. We need to change legislation, but we also need to deepen and change how people think about how we solve problems. And we're working on this on every level from, you know, racism, sexism, mass incarceration, climate change, equal rights. And we don't shy away from controversy. We're working right now on a film about testosterone poisoning and toxic masculinity. That's probably going to go over like a lead balloon in some areas of the world, but when 97% of all violent crime worldwide is committed by men, it's time to have a conversation. And I think it can be a very positive and empowering conversation for men, actually. So we like to really dig into hard topics. We also are so honored to be able to do the campaigns that we do with groups like the ACLU, where we come in and it's about fixing something in the moment. We need this governor to pass this particular budget that will help them adequately fund public defenders. How do we use culture to make that happen? These are the kinds of things that come to us all the time. And we have also become super tech geeks during this evolution because making great content and telling powerful stories doesn't matter if no one sees them. People are inundated these days online and in, at the touch points where they live, you know, our phones, with stories of conflict and violence, and we want to flood them with stories of solutions, of healers and world changers and thought provokers and paradigm shifters and peacemakers. And that's why we were drawn to the work with the David Lynch Foundation, because I know firsthand, as a child of poverty in a broken home, how much stress affects everything, how hard it is to think of yourself as a potential change maker when you're finding it hard to change your own circumstance, and how hard it is to feel that you could be a healer when you yourself feel so broken, and how hard it is to be your best self or even think of how you might contribute to the world when you're just fighting to survive. So change truly does start within ourselves, by first believing that we're worthy and that we can and must contribute. And when we take that light of change out into the world, that's when I believe we're most powerful. You know, with meditation, I evolved from, fuck that, don't tell me what to do, don't tell me what I can't do, sorry, to I joyously conceive of what I will do. I see what needs to be done, and I have the tools and the community around me to try. And so it's not always in the achieving I've learned, it's not always about winning, but winning is nice. There's just power and decency and grace in the attempt. That's what I found. So I still believe in the aggregate power of people. I've seen it change huge things and small things many times over the past 15 years of doing this work. We obviously have a whole lot of work left to do. I don't want to leave a planet ravaged by violence and inequality and runaway climate change to my child or to any of our children. You know, we can and must do better. So I encourage you to try. And you can contribute meaningfully. I know that you can. I feel I've been able to, and I still have a lot left to do. And there are a million ways to get involved. And you know, we're all interconnected, and we all matter in this deeply interconnected world. So I'm excited to see you try. And that's all.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay.
I love you. It's so good. So
good. Now I have to follow that. Mundane. I just wanted to talk for just a couple minutes about the kind of artistic thread of how we tell our stories. When I started out my career after college, I was working in journalism, like pop journalism, pretty shallow stuff, and I was always frustrated at how phony the stories seemed. And so when the internet appeared in mid-90s, I started working for one of the first online magazines. There were like three of them then. And
I know.
They called the magazines webzines. It was called word.com. The URL is now owned by Merriam-Webster's Dictionary. And the only way to see word.com is by going to a site called the Wayback Machine. So you can see how obscure this has become. But at the time, the exciting thing was telling real people's stories. The person who was my boss, a woman named Marisa Beau, was a moderator at a BBS, a bulletin board system that started in like 1990 called The Echo. And it was an offshoot of something called The Well in San Francisco, where before there were such a thing as web browsers, people were online telling stories and meeting each other and expressing themselves, and it was kind of an underground culture. And the internet now in 1995 was a way to explode that culture into the mainstream, and it was really exciting. And we would reach out to people from The Echo and get them to tell real stories just from a regular person's point of view, and to me they were really emotionally affecting and touching, and you learned about. It didn't fit into the kind of grid of a regular journalistic story. And out of that, we created a book called Gig that was actually a recreation of Studs Terkel's book Working from 1974. It was Americans talking about their jobs. And through that, through learning about people's everyday realities and the challenges of their jobs, you learned so much about other people, the rest of our country. And it actually made me realize that the more we learn about each other, the more empathy we can create for each other, and the more we can realize that we have in common. You know, and today in this divisive climate that we live in, I think we need that more than ever. So the interesting thing is when Laura and I started working together, one of the first things that we did, Laura edited a book inspired partly by gig and Stud Circle's working called Hurricane Housing. It was right after Hurricane Katrina. So many people had been displaced from their homes, and Move On members created a program that took them in into their personal homes and gave them a new place to live. And Laura sent out editors. It housed 30,000 people. And so there were people gathering their stories, and we created this book. The foreword was written by then Senator Barack Obama. We gathered the people together who had been housed, and there were people from all spectrum of culture, and they learned about each other, and it felt like a kind of a paradigm shift. And so now, when we starting with Art Not War, one of our specialty is again telling people's stories. I call it their unimpeachable truth. You know, when politics, there's so many alternative facts, but the one thing that you can't take away from someone is their truth, and that's what we always try to get to when we create media. We create videos, portraits of people telling their truth, and hopefully, by doing that, we can change culture very slowly and steadily and in a real way, and then change policy. We need to do both, but before you can change policy, you need to change culture, and by doing that, people need to communicate with each other. Which you want to show? Actually, there's one. This one is called Pay It Forward Pizza, which the website Upworthy asked us to create. We did it on an incredibly low budget, really quickly, and it's a portrait of a pizza place in Philadelphia, and it became Upworthy's most viewed piece of original content. It's, I think, 62 million views right now, so.
I've been homeless on and off for the past 5 years, so it really sucks, but at least I know I can look forward to 11 o'clock when I know I can get some fresh hot pizza.
The first day of the Pay It Forward program kind of started was when a gentleman walked in and he asked if a homeless person ever came in short, and he offered to pre-purchase a slice of pizza for the next homeless person. So he gave me $1. I ran out, got post-it notes, put one up on a wall behind the register, told more people about it. Eventually, a couple days later, a homeless person came in. He had like 65 cents on him, and we told him to just keep the change. It was already paid for. He redeemed one of the pre-purchased slices. So now we've given away almost 10,000 slices of pizza.
I feel, well, you know, welcome. I feel like, you know, like I almost bought the slice, but I know I didn't.
I try to donate at least like $5 a week, you know, and it's so funny because today I left my wallet and everything home, and I have 78 cents in my pocket, and I just came out, I was like, I'm a little short. They were like, okay, don't worry about it. And that's a really great feeling. You know, so I can imagine how the homeless people feel. And it's just a great thing. And the pizza is good. I'm from New York, so you know I know what pizza is.
Before I opened up Roses, I just worked at a desk job in New York. You know, I showed up every morning, did some computer work, and then, you know, went home. Pretty regular stuff. I wanted to kind of do something new. I saw the success of the dollar pizza stores throughout New York. So I thought I'd open this place up and try my hand at it.
I've been 3 years off the streets. I was 7 years homeless myself as a veteran, you know, and I finally got myself out of the rut, got myself an income, and I want to pay it forward, you know.
Oh, just yesterday there was a guy that came in. He'd been homeless for like 8 months, and I hadn't seen him for like 3 months. And I'm like, yo, where you been at? He's like, yeah, I'm working now. Figured I'd buy a slice for someone else. I was like, that was awesome. Just a couple days prior, I had been like, man, I hope that guy's okay. And it turns out, you know, he's killing it.
We don't always have a chance to come in and get fresh, hot food whenever we can. and for people to donate money, you know, towards slices of pizza for us, like, really made a change in Philadelphia.
In a city with the poverty rate that is higher than all other big cities comparable to it, to see such a show of compassion and brotherly love is really inspiring.
I think it's pretty cool how powerful something this kind of small and simple can be.
So we have time for about two questions.
Great. Hello. My name is Amr, and thank you guys for the really like amazing work you're doing. And I know that there is like lots and lots more to be done. I agree like 100% that art is the best way to reach to people, and generally creative work, because it reaches directly to their feeling and bypass their rationale. That's like usually blocks everything. Like one thing that I would like to say here is that away from politics, what rages wars, and like because I come from Middle East, the place of like ongoing war all the time, is that there are some people behind it who make lots of benefits. People who like may produce weapons or whatever they do, but they're making lots of money out of it. That's in short. And when I came here to the States, like I have seen also some other parts like have been abused, like for example, pharmaceutical companies, healthcare, like so many other things, like so ridiculous. I mean, ridiculously expensive and not that good in terms of service. So what I'm saying is that changing the people and people direction, that would really, really help. But also, going for the solving. Okay, it's not me.
Your question?
No. Oh, so how do we?
No,
how do
I appreciate. Yeah.
How do we address those things? Like you know, when there is a hungry child reaching to cookies, unless his mother or her mother like feed them proper food, they will always go back and reach for cookies. So how can we address this? How can we help the economy to balance and like be able to minimize the influence of those people really hungry that wants to eat the world by raging wars and controlling things that are really necessary for people like healthcare? That's it.
I think I understand your question. And I think the answer is that capitalism is a problem, right? I mean, I think, if I understand your question correctly. And so I think that we have to, I always get frustrated when people get hung up on the isms, right? We have a lot of different isms, political isms from the past, socialism, capitalism. We are in a different place in history than ever before. We're more interconnected than ever before. We need to develop an entire new ism. We need to develop an entire new economic model that is not based on the 1% controlling the vast preponderance of wealth and resources on this earth. That's just my feeling. Now, that's a pretty big nut to crack, right? But I believe it's possible, and I think that we've seen the stirrings of revolt around the world. We saw it with the Occupy movement. We saw it with the Arab Spring. What we need is potentially an even better and even more interconnected, I think, peaceful path forward that involves, there's many prongs. I mean, I could talk about this for hours and hours and hours, right? How do we reshape how people, how do we reshape and rethink capitalism? How do we come up with something brand new, an economic model that works for everybody? I got to wrap it up. Sorry.
Yeah.
No. Sorry, that's too big of a question.
Yeah. Next question. Yes.
Okay. Yes, you do need a microphone. You do need a microphone.
I do?
Absolutely need a microphone.
Thank you. Okay, I'm asking this question for all of us in this room, and I'm doing it because of what you guys are doing, and I think in order to change anything, we need to understand our history. What happened? Something has been placed upon us. We don't know what it is, but it's not our world. This question is to everyone. Are you an American citizen or are you a U.S. citizen? There's a difference between U.S. and USA of A. Look it up. Stay away from anything.gov. Go on torrent or private search engines. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think there's a question.
The question is, are you an American citizen or are you a U.S. citizen? Thank you.
Thank you. And I want to just comment on these last question. The beautiful thing about this series that we're going to be holding here on change makers and disruptors transforming the world for good is that every topic is going to be looked at. Economics, healthcare, agriculture, defense, everything is in need of disruptive innovation, everything, because the world is changing. And so what has worked or sort of worked in the past, we need to relook at it. We need to look at it with a fresh eyes and a fresh, clear mind. And that beautiful quote from the Bhagavad Gita, with a resolute intellect. That means clear, focused. They say, like a candle in a windless place. So that's what we need to do. So everything, and the work that these two, you're going to say something, but the work that these two are doing and all of us, this is just why we're having these series of conferences. And the David Lynch Foundation and the Abramson Center for Peace is so excited to be partnering with Dr. Hagelin and this community, Maharshi University of Management, to make this the center of these essential conversations that can truly change the world. Yes.
And I just wanted to leave you with, I also just would encourage you to think that sometimes things have to happen incrementally. Sometimes your job is just to inch something forward. But sometimes your job, I mean, I get brought in as a consultant a lot, and I was just working with some group of people about how to address the massive pollution problem in Southern California, which is becoming a real crisis. And finally, I just said, why doesn't some billionaire just do a buyback and replace every car in LA County with an electric car? And they're like, that's crazy. I was like, no, it's completely possible. Do you know how much it costs? Because I did the math. You know, it doesn't even cost that much. So sometimes you need to be the person saying something ridiculous and unruly that makes people think about things differently. So I encourage you to think huge. How do we change capitalism? But also to think, what can I do right now that just moves the ball forward on something in my community, in my family, in my country, in my state? Sometimes just making an hour's worth of calls to elect a person who thinks like you do and shares your values is very, very powerful as well. So,
like Ed Malloy. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Wait a second.